Hi, I'm Riley Fessler. I'm a podcast producer here at the DSR Network, which means that my job is to make sure that we have great content and great guests across all of our shows. Our programming is supported by our members, and for that, we are truly grateful. I hope that you'll consider becoming a member to support the work that we do. Members receive an ad-free listening experience, bonus content for nearly all of our shows, early access to episodes, enhanced show notes, and access to our exclusive DSR Slack and Discord communities. Membership is just $7 per month or $70 per year. To become a member, please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy. Thank you very much for your support. Today's episode from The Silo is a Words Matter from March of last year, featuring a conversation between Norman Cavita on the collapse of Silicon Valley Bank and the Biden administration's actions to save its depositors. We hope you enjoy.
This is Words Matter with Norm Ornstein.
We've got the votes and screw the rest of you.
And Dr. Cavita Patel.
These might be some of the smaller moments, you know, with all the bombshells. Didn't catch people's eyes.
Welcome to Words Matter, a podcast of the DSR Network. Each week, Norm Ornstein and I try to break down what our leaders are saying, doing, or not saying or doing as we enter into yet again another election cycle. And Norm, as predicted, we are going to have a lot to talk about. I can honestly confess, and this may or may not be of interest, I actually have my mortgage with a bank that failed on Friday, so that I will be very interested and was quite concerned when, you can imagine, on Friday, I got the flash across my phone that probably you did as well, that the FDIC has gone in to move and close Silicon Valley Bank in maybe some utter hallucination that I had. I thought maybe this means my mortgage will be canceled, but I don't think I'll get so lucky. Let's put it this way. I won't get as lucky as many of the people who did get a bailout in many aspects. I'm curious kind of your thoughts, reactions, and then when we get a chance, I might go through what I think were the sequence of events that have probably not been discussed as much in terms of, you know, people are trying to kind of identify who's at fault. And I would argue we all are, including myself, who got a mortgage from there because it was an incredibly, just I'll be honest with you, they were offering like lower rates to refinance. And I had never heard of the bank, honestly. And I had a friend who said, yeah, they're doing pretty competitive mortgage rates. And I thought, well, it's a bank and it says FDIC and what could go wrong? So there we go. Your thoughts, Norm. Well,
you know, my son, Danny, who's been doing a startup out in California, had some money in the bank, as every startup did. And in fact, it was almost a requirement for investors to do so. Now, you know, his was not anywhere close to the presumed $250,000 limit, although that doesn't matter anymore anyhow. There's so much to talk about here in so many different ways. I want to point to two areas of failure first. One, which has now been talked about a lot, but it bears repeating, is the watering down of the regulations. It was pushed by this bank, the Silicon Valley Bank, and its executives, among many others. It was embraced by Donald Trump and Republicans, but we also have to note, given money in politics and just the nature of our political system, plenty of Democrats went along. A lot of them were bitterly opposed. And obviously, the part of this that matters is the so-called stress test. And that is periodically examining banks, and in particular, big and middle-sized banks, to make sure that they're not doing what it turns out Silicon Valley Bank was doing. And what it was doing basically was making investments that on the surface were super cautious and prudent, but in fact were utterly reckless, which is tying up your assets in low interest, long-term treasuries that are not at all liquid, but without any understanding that almost everybody in the world had that interest rates were going to go up and probably go up significantly, that we were going to end up with some inflation, and that you were going to get caught in a vice, that all of a sudden those investments were going to be worth a lot less. You were going to take big losses. And to get rid of them, if you had a run on the bank or if people needed the money, was going to be almost impossible for you. So if those regulations had been in place, it is very, very likely that they would have been barred from making those investments or talked out of it, and they would have been more realistically prudent. And whether we get the regulations back, what we're seeing, of course, what Republicans are saying is not, oops, we blew it here. It is, well, this is a woke bank, because they were diverted into thinking about diversity and inclusion, and that's why they blew it. So we have to be a little bit skeptical about whether we'll do the right thing now. The second place to turn for errors here is the Fed. The Fed regulates these banks. It's not just FDIC. It's not just the controller of the currency. And Jerome Powell and his people at the Fed blew it with this one. They should have known, as interest rates were rising, that it was going to create a real problem for banks. So before all of this is done, I hope we get some real oversight instead of the ridiculous phony oversight that we're seeing in the House right now under Kevin McCarthy and James Comer and Jim Jordan. Get some real oversight of what the Fed did and what needs to be done, and some real discussion about how you can build back in the safeguards that are obviously necessary here. But I can't say that I'm wildly optimistic that we'll get that happening. And, you know, I think we should note that the steps that were taken were probably the necessary steps, because we were beginning to see a run on other mid-sized banks, and it could have created a real ripple effect. Much as it makes me gag to think of these libertarian Silicon Valley types who are decry government interference in anything until they want their own welfare, it was actually the right thing to do. So,
okay. So I have much to say here. Let me offer, though, as I sometimes try to do when we were emailing back and forth about what to discuss. We had so much, as we mentioned, we actually will try to cover as some details emerge from the Amarillo, Texas hearing on the FDA, like the validity of the very valid FDA authorization of mifepristone, which we've covered in past pods. That is happening as we're taping for this pod, the hearing that is, and details will come out after. So maybe we'll cover that in a future pod. But when you and I were emailing, I actually decided to kind of, I remember 08, and I remember very vividly thinking, by the way, having had no money at that time to even afford a mortgage. So I kept thinking I was in the White House in 09 thinking, oh, this could never happen to me, because now we've learned, right? In 09, we've learned, and this will never happen again. I do want to kind of offer that there seems to be some differences, and why I don't think that this is as systemic of a problem as it was in 08, 09. But here's why, and this is just from me looking through some history about Silicon Valley Bank, which, as you mentioned, many of their depositors were startups. And what's interesting is that in a complete outlier, something like 97% of their depositors were above the insurance limits, meaning 97% of the deposits were uninsured. So these are kind of, you know, as you mentioned, startups, and they had incredibly large amounts of money that they were depositing. COVID helped that, right? Because of all the money that flowed through to the health and tech sector during COVID. And it, essentially then, Silicon Valley Bank, having sat on all this money that came in through these depositors, which were highly unusual, not regular Americans, let's put it that way, except for me that has, except for who have a very regular American mortgage that I got a good rate on, which I'm going to be very honest with people. I thought, this is great. I'm doing the American dream, refinancing my mortgage with this bank I had not really been familiar with. But essentially what Silicon Valley Bank did is then lent a large proportion of that deposited money that was mostly uninsured to the federal government in the form of U.S. treasuries. And this was when interest rates were low. And so this is a common practice. But anything I just said, correct me if I'm wrong, Norm, is not really out of line, except for this outlier of sitting on this incredible amount of money and then putting all of that money into U.S. treasuries, which were at like a 1% interest rate at the time, and then also putting them into homeowners exactly like me when interest rates were also very just incredibly low, historically low rates during COVID. And instead of doing that on a shorter term duration, they did this in longer term durations. I'm trying to speak as the non-banking finance person, but I've been trying to unpack and understand this. And then to be clear, even though it was done with, I mean, I am a taxpaying, my accountant tells me I overpay my taxes because I'm always worried that I'll get accused of shortcutting something one day. So I'm a taxpaying, wanted to find a good interest rate refinance. I did everything by the book. However, it's the bank's management that was making these critical mistakes, not just recently. This has been the Wall Street Journal. I found an article, Norm, October of 2022. And shame on me, by the way. I got my bank financing 2 years ago, and then I just kind of turned it off. They were just like a bank that I put an auto payment to and honestly didn't pay attention to. October of 22, there was a series of articles that came out in the fall about the overinvestment and this kind of hedge that they were making on the management side on these large, you know, government securities. And basically, when interest rates then rose, fewer deposits came in because that venture capital funding was starting to dry up as well. And then the market value of those securities, both my long-term mortgage and then the treasury, like the securities in the form of U.S. Treasury notes, all of that value came crashing down because who would want to buy a 10-year treasury at 1% when you could directly buy one from the government, which also, by the way, disclosure, I did directly from the government. I bought mine. There was an offer for a one-year $10,000 treasury note for 9%, no more than $10,000, which is fine because that's a lot of money. And so why would I go and buy anything at 1%? So then this brings up the fact that, in fact, this bank, to your point now, of it's not just the FDIC, and actually, I would say the FDIC, this was interestingly enough over the weekend, I learned, as you've already pointed out, this is not just one entity. It's actually a combination, FDIC, Treasury outside of, you know, Treasury itself, FDIC, an independent kind of corporation funded by member banks. And then, as you point out, the Fed. And then I think somewhere in there, Congress, because of Dodd-Frank, right? So we have to talk about Dodd-Frank. Maybe you can touch on that for a second. So it was like a tripartite, maybe four parties had to come to agreement about what to do in the case of the bank's insolvency. And basically, they've been technically insolvent for months. And the company basically had more assets than liabilities, but a huge chunk of those assets could not turn liquid into cash. Otherwise, they could have been decent. And so that's the situation they were in. I actually listened to a recording of a Zoom call their CEO did on last Thursday, literally the day before the bank government came in and shut them down. And I just heard a snippet of it. It's on YouTube for anybody interested. It basically just, he said, you know, we are sound, we are solvent. It's never been a better time to think about Silicon Valley Bank. And then not just 24 hours later, we find out that lo and behold, the CEO and a number of the management team sold off many of their stock. They had also, here's what you may not know, Norm. I don't know if this is in the paper. I heard Andrew Ross Sorkin say this on MSNBC, and I don't know if it's been carried enough through. It has in Twitter, but for our listeners, Friday, March 10th, the very day they got shut down, when I wondered, maybe your son wondered what's happening, what's going on to their money and to my mortgage and what this means, they got bonus payouts. The entire executive management team and many of their management got their bonus payouts. To be sure, that was a scheduled bonus payout that everybody knew was going to happen on schedule for 2022. But could you imagine that those deposits hit the bank and yet wires or people trying to get their money out? And then the other piece that you brought up, and then I'll stop and see what you think, and maybe we can talk about Dodd-Frank because that hasn't come up enough yet. The other part that I will say is what you brought up with not just like kind of Silicon Valley tech bros, but a very small circle of Twitter tech bros that saw what was happening and then literally took their money out, told their firms and their employees and their small companies, startup companies rather, to take their money out. And that is what is a very common failure mode for banks, what we call a bank run. And so and if a depositor fears that a bank is running out of money, obviously logic would behold that you'd want to pull your funds, but it makes it worse. And that's why I think you saw many senators, the president himself coming out to the podium on, you know, Monday morning, to say, banks are, we are in charge of these two banks, one that was smaller in the New York region, but the American banking system is sound, basically, was the Biden's words. All right, Norm, react to that, or maybe talk about Dodd-Frank and the role here that Dodd-Frank
played. Well, first, I think it's worth talking a little bit about the bank runs. What does a bank do? A bank takes your money in, and it doesn't hold it there in its vaults. It takes the money, paying you either nothing or a small rate, does mortgages where it brings in your money, paying a low rate, but it takes that money and invests it for itself with the idea that it will make money by investments that will pay off more than they're paying out to hold other people's money. Now, no bank keeps on hand or anywhere close by, anywhere close to the money that people have put in. And so if you get a panic and people say, oh, we need our money now, banks are in trouble. You go back to the Depression, and the whole reason for creating the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation and putting the federal government's guarantee behind deposits for most Americans. For a long time, it was still a large amount, $100,000, and then it went to $250,000 with the 2008 crisis, and it's stayed there. But the idea was you don't need to panic, you don't need to worry. Even if there's an issue in this bank, you'll be made whole. And it's paid for by the banks themselves putting in money, it's insurance. We don't normally have bank panics and bank runs. This was one, and it would have been more easily resolved, obviously, if they had put their money into assets that were liquid. This was colossal failure on the part of the management. And what I hope will happen now is that not only are they fired, they're out, they're not going to be involved anymore with this bank. Remember, it was the CEO who was one of the most active lobbyists to try and weaken the regulations, with the absurd argument, by the way, that Silicon Valley Bank wasn't a big or mid-sized bank, it was just a small one, which was not the case. But I hope they claw back and find a way to claw back what they made in those bonuses. Whatever they were for, the payout should not have been made, given where the bank was. But also, I hope the Justice Department and the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, will look carefully at these sales of stock. If the bank executives knew, and my guess is there are probably emails and other communications that will tell us, if they knew that they were on the verge of collapsing or having an issue taking place and they dumped their stock, that is most likely illegal. And they're miscreants here. I have to say, Kavita, my first reaction when I heard that Peter Thiel, who's not one of my favorite people, had led this bank run, it was, boy, I'd like to find out what the motive was here. Now, in retrospect, I think we can say he, as some others, were smart enough to see that this bank was in a precarious place because of the reckless actions of its management. And that maybe it was actually a reasonable motive. Let's get out before it turns really bad. But, you know, we also have to look at apparently one firm, and a lot of this money is crypto money, which to me is a warning signal in and of itself. Apparently, one crypto firm I have read had $3.3 billion in this bank. And while, you know, okay, I understand all of the prudent reasons for making people whole. What the hell is going on when you know that there is an FDIC limit of $250,000 and you're gambling with billions when stuff can happen? So it's not like the people who are being made whole necessarily deserve to be made whole. And when I see these, I'll come back to it. It's just so obnoxious to see these Silicon Valley libertarians who decry government, most of whom are probably saying, how can you give back these student loan payments to people who got into a deal? This is what capitalism is all about. Now are welfare queens, basically. They're all begging, crying, and pleading for the government to bail them out. Well, we're going to bail them out because it's in the national interest to do so. But nobody should have their eyes closed to the hypocrisy here.
Yeah, so let me do my best to try to figure out how to summarize, like, then what goes forward and how has... I mean, there have been others on television and the written word, kind of now we're here as well to talk about, have we prevented what I was hoping that this was, I saw as more of a less systemic issue, but certainly something that could be a problem. And people are saying for regional banks of different places and different sizes, we saw the New York regional bank close that didn't get too much attention, but something the government did. And then also people worried about a run on other regional banks like in Virginia, First Republic. There's some other ones that are in the area. And I think the government making it, what the government doing by stepping in is essentially saying that we're going to guarantee deposits at this particular bank, Silicon Valley Bank, but that we're not necessarily guaranteeing all deposits at what they call systemically important banks. And I think that's what limited to like what Bank of America, maybe Wells Fargo, Capital One. I mean, our U.S. There's a handful, PNC. There's just a handful of banks that probably fit into that profile. I can tell you, I have. I said I had my mortgage at Silicon Valley Bank. I have my regular banking. I have two banks. Ironically, I still keep a Senate Federal Credit Union Bank. I actually am glad that I do, so that I feel like that's going to be the bank that really should not fail. Or if it does, it's last in line to fail because it's guaranteed by like every federal worker and pension employee in the federal system. And then I use Capital One. I got an incoming of just the spam email and calls from Capital One that kind of all these new offers to open accounts. And so you can tell that even if this, you know, Silicon Valley Bank was kind of a smaller bank, I think they said number 16 by size, it has a real ripple effect and it's meaningful. And I think that these are not small issues to be taken lightly. So here's the question, and maybe we'll close here. Now, what I'm worried about, Norm, is that whatever Biden's words are, there seems to be a message that that 250,000 FDIC limit, which I hope every listener on this podcast actually has the daily opportunity to be uninsured because they're going in above that amount. I would love to see that happen in the United States. However, it does seem to me, call me a Luddite, does seem like they are pretty much whatever their words are, they're making effective that FDIC 250 is not relevant. So what does it matter to even have that insurance ceiling? Does it matter? What do you think would happen if, let's say, we hear about some other banks kind of getting toppled or getting close to teetering? Norm, what are your thoughts?
Yeah, so it's a complicated issue in some ways. Silicon Valley Bank did not completely run out of money. And obviously, what's going to happen here? We're getting all these assurances, which I believe that taxpayers are not going to be on the hook for this. What the government is going to do is turn the securities that Silicon Valley Bank has into some other investments. And they're going to take money from other banks to be able to fulfill all of this for whatever other losses occur. Of course, the idea that taxpayers aren't going to pay if banks have to pour a lot of money into this, they're going to find other ways to get the money back, which is going to come from their depositors. But I can understand the reasons for doing this. And I can understand saying, okay, there is no moral hazard effect here, but there is a moral hazard issue. And what happens going forward? If people now believe that there is no limit, it's not going to affect most of America, which doesn't have $250,000 to throw around or large sums of money beyond that to put in. But those who do, including businesses, may now be less prudent about what they do with their money. And they may end up putting that money into banks that are even more reckless. Maybe what we'll find is, getting back to what you said, and it's going to be interesting to see if there are ripple effects here, Kavita. So the big banks are going to try and take advantage of this. And the smaller, medium-sized regional banks, where people now are thinking, oh, I don't know, maybe I shouldn't keep my money there. And businesses that might do that are going to be in more trouble. So they may decide that they need to offer better deals, higher interest paid out for money put into checking accounts or money market accounts, lower interest rates for mortgages, which gives them more exposure, after all, if interest rates go up. If that's the case, then we're going to have more risk in these small and medium-sized banks. And if people, including businesses, say, hey, they're paying more money and there's no problem with the $250,000 limit, I'll put in millions, we're going to have a bigger problem down the road. I mean, this is one where our regulators are going to have to figure out how to strike a different balance here, or we could see history repeating itself
in a bad
again
way.
And again.
Yeah. And in a, and especially if get at these discrete sectors where these regions happen to be like First Republic, which I mean, I know it has other locations, that a lot of government workers, a lot of city workers, municipal workers, pension funds that invest money and invest in these regional banks. So it is a ripple effect. Like Peter Thiel can take out his money and billions of dollars and cause this sucking void and a bank run. And then the aftershocks or the knock-on effects, as they call it, could be seen for, honestly, as you're pointing out, for months and years later. Well, we will stay tuned because the Treasury Department did announce that they're launching an investigation, which is what we expected. And I'm assuming that former CEO of SVB, whose name I cannot remember, but the Zoom video that was captured on YouTube, I have a good gut feeling that he should probably just get a suite at the Mayflower very close to Congress and to the White House, because he's going to be there for a while. So that hopefully will bear some fruit over the next weeks, and we'll keep our listeners posted. Wanting to thank everyone for being an incredible listener, and hope that if you enjoyed today's discussion of not just bank failures, but kind of a meandering of the week's events, that you will rate, review, and subscribe, and tell your other friends to subscribe to Words Matter podcast. The production of the DSR Network. Our incredible executive producer is Chris Cotnoir, and our wonderful, amazing producer for this podcast is Grant Paver. Our next pods will be in your inbox should be March 23rd, and we look forward to seeing you then. All right, welcome to our members-only section for Words Matter. We're so glad that you're here, and we hope that you can also, after you listen, if you are so inclined, not just to give us feedback, but also ask others to encourage them to join as a member. All right, Norm, we were challenged with what to talk about in this section, and you made a compelling, I would say, incredibly eloquent argument to do something that I had been not thinking it would be March of 2023 and we'd be talking about, which is Ron DeSantis' presidential bid. We knew we'd be talking about that, but his really incredible words on Russia and Ukraine. And then that goes into a little bit of a foray into the geopolitics of Russia as it stands in the United States, which I thought you had some interesting thoughts on before we actually started recording. Norm, what was tell me your reaction? I have to say my only reaction is that Nikki Haley, along with kind of getting awards for being the first idiot out there to say that she was running for president, did a decent job of getting Trump kind of riled up to both, you know, doom and gloom from all of his speeches and piling on to the woke conversation about the banks. So I will say I was much more distracted by Trump's incredibly eloquent words on the state of affairs in the United States. It didn't give as much attention to DeSantis or to what is evolving between DeSantis, Russia, and Ukraine. But tell me, Norm, what your thoughts are.
So there are a couple of broad themes here to think about. You have the two most prominent Republican contenders for the presidential nomination, Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis, have sided firmly now with Vladimir Putin against Ukraine and Volodymyr Zelensky. Putin is thrilled with this, I am sure. Now, that doesn't mean everybody is going along, but what it tells us is that the zeitgeist of the Republican Party now is pro-Russian, basically. And I was thinking about the reality that the Republican Party for decades, many, many decades, most of our lifetime, defined itself by being anti-communist, anti-Soviet Union, anti-Russia. And now it's a complete reversal. And of course, it's a dangerous reversal because there is little doubt that Russia is an enormous adversary of ours, and it sees its own interests as inimical to those of the United States. And that the Republican Party has moved in this direction is gobsmacking. But the second part of this is about DeSantis and also what it means going forward. With DeSantis, it is increasingly clear, it has been for some time, he doesn't really believe much of anything. He will take any position if he thinks it will benefit him. And it tells us something about where the Republican Party's voters are, that he's made a calculus that being pro-Russian and anti-Ukrainian and referring to this as a territorial dispute, not an invasion, that that's where the voters will be. Now, he's not getting away with this entirely. I saw that Lindsey Graham, Marco Rubio, and some others have taken exception to him. They're still very much on the side of freedom and Ukraine, but it's worrisome. And what's more worrisome is, since these are the two front runners, and Trump is probably going to be indicted in New York sometime in the next week, would be my guess. He will be indicted in Georgia sometime in the next few weeks. I would expect we'll see federal indictments coming forward. That doesn't prevent him from running. It doesn't prevent him from winning a nomination. I personally think DeSantis is much weaker than his press would suggest. He has no personal charm, and he hasn't been tested on this stage, and he's making an appeal to the broader public that's based on what he's done in Florida, all of those reasons. But if you're sitting there in the Kremlin, you're thinking, you know what? If I can just hold on and not get out of Ukraine and continue to suffer these massive losses of young men, mostly in Ukraine, hold on until January 20th of 2025, there's a good chance that I will have a president who will completely pull support from Ukraine, and we can prevail and get the prize that we've wanted, which is to make Ukraine a part of Russia. And that means that the incentive that DeSantis has unleashed now, the incentive for Russia to continue to pound away, kill Ukrainians, kill Russians along the way, is different and greater now. And it makes it an even more reckless, irresponsible, traitorous position, which are all terms I have long associated with Ron DeSantis.
Yes, it is. That is true. Those are terms I would have absolutely associated with Ron DeSantis. I have to, certainly, I should say, he hasn't actually officially declared his 2024 ambition, but we do expect it any day now. I want to just talk about the statement that he gave, which is, maybe I mentioned this, but failed to do it on this pod when you and I were talking. The part that struck me is that, you know, this was Tucker Carlson posting at least a response from Governor DeSantis's answers on Ukraine as part of this kind of series of questionnaires. I'm going to read some of the words from, this is Ron DeSantis speaking, but to Tucker Carlson, Fox News. While the U.S. has many vital national interests, securing our borders, addressing the crisis of readiness within our military, achieving energy security and independence, and checking the economic, cultural, and military power of the Chinese Communist Party, becoming further entangled in a territorial dispute between Ukraine and Russia is not one of them. The Biden administration's virtual blank check funding of this conflict for, quote, as long as it takes, close quote, without any defined objectives or accountability, distracts from our country's most pressing challenges. Without question, peace should be the objective. He's a politician. He knew he had to put that in there. The United States should not provide assistance that could require the deployment of American troops or enable Ukraine to engage in offensive operations beyond its borders. That was when I paused and thought, wow, this is, you know, I was with him at peace should be the objective, you know, thoughts and prayers. That's very typical. I got to be honest, though. When I saw the U.S. should not be providing assistance, including the deployment of American troops or, quote, enabling Ukraine to engage in offensive operations beyond its borders,
no mention of this, like, oh, but, you know, Russia, who cares what they do? It's not a problem. The Biden administration goes on to continue and then I'll stop, but it's great. The Biden administration's policies have driven Russia into a de facto alliance with China. Because China has not and will not abide by the embargo, Russia has increased its foreign revenues while China benefits from cheaper fuel. Coupled with his intentional depletion of the Strategic Petroleum Reserve, we didn't get to talk about Alaska and drilling, by the way, but we can maybe save that, and support for the left's Green New Deal, Biden has further empowered Russia's energy-dominated economy and Putin's war machine at Americans' expense. So what I will say, though, Norm, and we can leave it here for now, we really should touch on Alaska and drilling at some point, because I do think that's a very good topic that is not outside of what we just discussed today. I have to tell you, DeSantis is not stupid. And so what he does, the words are stupid. However, the way he has now injected into the conversation, everything you just spoke about, but I will say by making China like the boogeyman constantly, consistently, while also then giving like shade, not just to Biden and Ukraine and Russia to some degree, he's basically setting up what I think did work for Trump in 2016, which is this resentment of an American public that does not necessarily have the audience attention span to do anything other than listen to these sound bites on popular news venues, including MSNBC, and people don't go further. And then this becomes fact and reality, Norm. This statement I'm reading from becomes fact. And that is exactly how we have gotten into trouble. Everything we've talked about on this show, that has been a common thread, including for liberals, including for conservatives, left, right, center. And I do feel like this is something that we're going to have to contend with, even if DeSantis does not become president. This ability to change the narrative, translate facts, translate what is taken as fact and evidence by just putting out these very confident statements with some underlay, like there's truth to some pieces of this. Anyway, that's where I worry the most, listening to his words.
I think you're exactly right. And I, you know, just one last word on Russia and Ukraine. If Russia prevails here, the consequences for the U.S. down the road are going to be dire. We are still a part of NATO. There is little doubt that Russia would then begin to menace and try and move in on Poland, on Romania, on other countries that used to be in its orbit. And ultimately, the cost to the U.S. in trying to deter that aggression is going to be much, much greater. I did a tweet the other day. I'm old enough to remember a classic commercial. It was for Fram oil filters. And it was basically a mechanic with a car in his shop saying, this guy didn't change his oil and he's got to replace his engine. It's going to cost thousands. And if he put in a Fram oil filter, it would have been different. And the tagline was, you can pay me now a few bucks for a filter, or you can pay me later thousands for a new engine. And I thought of this in the same context, that the price we're paying here, the weapons that we're sending, and by the way, for most of them, it's actually a boon to the American economy because it's American manufacturers who are doing well with this, is a small one. And it's, you know, the Russian military is being devastated. There's internal division there. But if we deter Russia here, it is a much smaller price than we'll have to pay if we don't deter them now and then have to face much more dire consequences later. And that's a message that's not getting across as much as the one that DeSantis is putting out there. You're so right, Kavita. He's hit on a kernel of something that almost always hits Americans, and it has whenever we faced a conflict anywhere else. Why aren't we spending the money at home? There are so many needs here. Or, of course, DeSantis wouldn't spend it at home, but it resonates with a lot of people, and it's a dangerous thing. And now it's the official doctrine of leaders of a major political party, and that's unsettling.
Yep. And it's also, I think, to be honest, it's just really putting it again. We shouldn't go on longer, so I'll stop here. It's putting Democrats into this posture of having to react rather than what I feel like I have not seen enough, other than outside of President Biden, I'll give it, you know, Elizabeth Warren on the banking. I mean, I would say there are a handful of leaders and they tend to be into kind of pocket issues. And it reminds me of 2020, where Elizabeth Warren was like, I got a policy for that. You know, so I almost, when I was reading DeSantis's words, I could see Elizabeth Warren in a corner going, I got a policy paper for that. And she does, because we know that Democrats have incredibly thoughtful kind of comments and have reflections on like the facts that are on the ground. We know that a lot of leaders have been on the ground in Ukraine to try to understand the situation unfolding. And so, but yet all we have are these reactive statements. So where are, again, you said it, like, you know, you can't bring a butter knife to like a gunfight. So where do you, or to whatever boxing ring, you can't do that. So how do we have some ability to be more thoughtful around these topics and give people a way to frame these issues without having to just be reactive to a statement and a powerful media statement where now candidates going straight, not to Fox News, just going straight to Tucker Carlson, right? This is like in COVID, going straight to Joe Rogan, going straight to the media, because that's where the public is, but not all media, just the media that's willing to bend the facts. So we're going to stop there. Our members certainly are going to have a lot to say. So hopefully you can engage on this topic. And maybe next time we'll certainly cover Texas abortion hearing and abortion medication hearing in Amarillo. We've got Alaska oil drilling. We'll have a number of topics to pick from, but thank you for joining us as always and look forward to seeing you soon.